Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. 20 years ago, Netflix changed the entertainment world by starting the seemingly mundane business of renting people DVDs by mail. An unlimited subscription service followed. 18 years ago, the company rolled out its first personalized algorithm. Suddenly, your viewing history could help predict what old shows or movies you would want to watch next, even if you didn't know. And in 2013, Netflix once again upended everything.
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. There is but one rule: hunt or be hunted.
That was actor Kevin Spacey playing fictional Congressman Frank Underwood in Netflix's first foray into original content, House of Cards. And Netflix was definitely on the hunt. This hour on Point, we venture inside the Netflix binge factory with a reporter who's been there. You can join us on air or online. Are you one of Netflix's 125 million subscribers? Tell us why and what you're watching. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later this hour, actress and comedian Mindy Kaling tells Dartmouth College grads, have insane confidence in yourself, even if it's not real. Joining me now from Las Vegas via Skype is Joe Adalian. He's the West Coast editor for New York Magazine's entertainment news site, Vulture.com. You can link to his cover story headlined Inside the Binge Factory at our website, onpointradio.org. Joe, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David.
I know you as TV Mojo with an E on the end of it on Twitter, but it's nice to talk to you in person. Wanted to ask you, what made you decide to go inside the Binge Factory, and what surprised you most once you were?
The thing is, Netflix right now is television, right? Netflix has, in the space of 5 years, sort of completely transformed the TV universe, and not by itself. Streaming is sort of the bigger thing that's changing television, but Netflix has been sort of the dominant player in streaming and in subscription video on demand. And honestly, part of the reason I want to do the story is so that I could better understand how they do it. How do they make so much programming, and how do they manage to make so much so quickly? There will be critics who say that, you know, when you make so much programming, it can't all be good. And surely there's plenty of stuff that critics would label not good. But the fact is, they've had a huge cultural impact in just 5 years. They're, you know, dramatically changing the way television's made. They're changing how we watch television. And it seemed that we needed to go in there and sort of find out how they did it.
So let's, Joe, let's have you break down some of that for us a little bit. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, okay, so Netflix is making a lot more now rather than simply just Disney or NBC Universal or any of a number of other big television movie studios in Hollywood. Why does it make the content that we're getting any different?
Well, one thing is we've never been able to have one network that does so much in one place, right? The big key realization I sort of got when I was there at Netflix is that it really is 15 or 16 different companies all at once. It really is, you know, we think of it first as sort of a network. When Netflix started doing originals, a lot of us, myself included, thought that it was going to try to be like HBO, right? It was going to try to do something where they had library content, which is movies from other studios and maybe some other TV shows that the, you know, old friends reruns, et cetera. And they would sprinkle that with originals to sort of stand out, to sort of be sort of must viewing, that you had to have to subscribe. And it's a model that HBO pioneered and did very well in the 70s and 80s. We saw more basic cable networks get into that to sort of increase their value to consumers with original series. And that's maybe when I even talked to Ted back in 2011, 2012, right before House of Cards launched, he told me he could see maybe one day getting to 20 shows, and that was only 5 years ago.
And that seemed like a decent number.
And it seemed, and actually it seemed then, I thought, oh, he's bragging. It's like, really, 20 shows? And
what do they got now?
Well, it's trying to get the exact number is difficult. They will make this year about 1,000 pieces of original content. Now, that's they will have on their service 1,000 pieces of original content. Now, that doesn't include things like The Friends or The Office libraries, but it does include shows like Riverdale, which is a show that's, we know in America as a CW show, but Netflix pays a premium fee so that everywhere else in the world, Riverdale airs, I believe, at the same time every week as a Netflix original. So, and vice versa, there are some shows like White Gold, which is a BBC, I believe, show that airs in the US as a Netflix original. But you know, the probably about 300 or 400 different kinds of shows that are truly Netflix originals, including unscripted, scripted movies that they're making. They're going to make about 80 movies this year. And so, anyway, the thing that struck me is how they changed strategy from doing that thing where they were just going to sort of spice up their library, sort of have must-see content. They realized that the rest of Hollywood wasn't going to let them have that content forever. They knew that Time Warner and Disney and everyone else would finally say, wait a second, what are you doing?
They license, you know, a show might appear on ABC and it might rerun on TBS or TNT or one of the basic channel shows, but they'd also sort of give their library licensing to Netflix and say, yeah, you can play the older ones for quite a while.
Exactly. And that was sort of we thought maybe they were just going to reinvent syndication, right? Instead of sitcoms airing forever on local TV stations, they'd air on Netflix. That's how people would get it. But Hollywood finally realized, well, we can't do this. They're stealing too much of our viewership base from our linear networks. And they basically said, we better change before we are left with no content. And so they started making their own, and it just became this sort of virtuous cycle that they set up where more content begat more content. So what's different is there's so much, and they're not trying to be one kind of network. They don't want to have a brand like HBO or FX have brands. They want to sort of be an entire cable system. They want to be sort of, you know, where the place where you go and you get your Home and Garden TV, your Food Network, your FX, your HBO, your CBS, your NBC, everything right now but live sports and news. They want to sort of have programming in those categories to serve that audience so that it's must-see, essential viewing, essential subscribership, rather, for everyone in the world.
Joe Adelian,
and they want to make sure.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and they also, we'll get into this later, they also want to extend the strategy around the world. So they want to have shows for people who live in India,
sure,
who have to definitely subscribe to Netflix.
And we will get to that in a bit. Joe Adelian of New York Magazine and Vulture.com. I want to give listeners just a little bit of an audio feel for that range. First, I'd like to start with a clip from the Netflix show 13 Reasons Why. The character Hannah Baker is played by Katherine Langford. She records a series of tapes that outline the reasons why she took her own life. Here's the introduction to the first tape.
Hey, it's Hannah Baker. Don't adjust your whatever device you're hearing this on. It's me, live and in stereo.
No return engagements, no encore, and this time absolutely no requests. Get a snack, settle in, because I'm about to tell you the story of my life. More specifically, why my life ended.
That obviously a very sensitive topic that Netflix had to address in recent days after the deaths of Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain. They also had recently a very popular hit with the show The Crown, in which Queen Elizabeth II, played by Claire Foy, takes Prime Minister Winston Churchill to task for keeping her in the dark about a major health crisis.
It seems that you have not been of sound body and mind these past weeks. That you chose to withhold that information from me. A decision which feels like a betrayal not just of the covenant of trust between us and the institutions that we both represent, but of our own personal relationship.
In addition, there was the hit 2015 documentary series called Making a Murderer, focused on Stephen Avery, his previous wrongful conviction, and his role in the 2005 murder of Teresa Halbach. In the third episode, defense attorney Dean Strong says that the police may have planted evidence linking Avery to the case.
I didn't see them plant evidence with my own two eyes. I didn't see it. But do I understand how human beings might be tempted to plant evidence under the circumstances in which the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department found itself after Stephen's exoneration? I don't have any difficulty understanding those human emotions at all.
And it appears as though this documentary itself played a role in the review of the conviction against Stephen Avery's nephew, linked to that murder itself. You know, this is Netflix having an effect in a journalistic way that we're not expecting of Netflix, which is a streaming entertainment service. Joe Adelian, what does this range of content do for Netflix? Why is it able to command so much more of our bandwidth and mind space than, say, you know, a Hollywood giant like Disney?
Well, you know, if Netflix people, Ted Sarandos, who runs is the chief content officer for Netflix, will tell you we're just getting started, that we actually need to get a lot more hours of viewing. Right now, I believe about the average person watches about 2 hours a day of Netflix, and they feel they can do a lot better since TV watching and screen watching is something like 8 or 9 hours, I think. You know, I don't know if they're actually able to do a better job of commanding more audience in the bigger picture. I think what they are able to do is they're able to get everybody in a way that traditional networks can't, because they through their algorithm are able to get shows to audiences that wouldn't normally watch it. They're the first truly global television network. Everything comes out mostly at the same dime, at the same day. And they do cater to everybody. Whereas, you know, most of those other companies, you know, Disney in some ways does cater everyone through its various networks. They just don't do it in one place. And therefore, their brands are more diffuse. Netflix, the secret is that it's all there for one low price, at least for now. I mean, I think we're going to continue to see them raising the price, although probably not too much higher.
Take 5 seconds. I'm going to ask each guest, what Netflix series are you watching?
I most recently am watching, that's a good question. I most recently binged Wild Wild Country, which is another docuseries that they have, and it was great.
Wild Wild Country. We have an endorsement there. Joe Adalian, stick around. We're taking a look inside the Netflix binge factory to find out how the company really works and why it works so well on us. You can join the conversation, of course. Do you like having so many movie and TV choices on Netflix, or does it leave you overwhelmed? Here's a sample of Regina Spektor with You've Got Time. It's the main title theme song for the Netflix original series Orange is the New Black. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Think of all the roads, think of all the crossings. Taking steps is easy, standing still is hard. Remember all their faces, remember all their everything is different the second time around.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing how Netflix is transforming the way the movie and TV industries operate and the viewing options of habits of its millions of subscribers, certainly me, and maybe you. You can join the conversation. What are we giving up by turning our choices over to Netflix? Should we be more worried about our personal privacy with on-demand streaming services? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Joe Adalian. He's author of this week's New Yorker magazine cover story, Inside the Binge Factory. And joining us now from Los Angeles, California, is Kim Masters. She's editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter and host of The Business on our sister public radio station, KCRW. She's written extensively about Netflix and the entertainment industry. You can find a link to one of her earlier stories on Hollywood's backlash against Netflix at our website, onpointradio.org. Kim, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me, David.
You got it. Let's first take a couple of quick calls. I'd like to hear from Frank. He's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Frank, go ahead.
Hey, David. I am a university chaplain here at the University of South Carolina, and I joined Netflix because all the students were joining it and thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And I'm just perplexed by it. I have watched The Crown. I've watched The House of Cards. I've watched a few things. But I find when I get on to Netflix, I literally browse for an hour or so and blow whatever time I had to binge watch, mm-hmm. just trying to decide what to watch. It's crazy.
So the suggestions don't work for you, and the choices are overwhelming, like going into Costco just wanting some ibuprofen or some Advil.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it feels like sort of television ADD, you know, with just, you know, I just get overwhelmed by everything and nothing. It's like something better is just around the next click.
Sure.
And then I find that I've wasted an hour, and I'm like, okay, well, I don't have any more time to watch television, so I just move on.
Well, it's like I guess a new network. You've got ABC, CBS, NBC, and ADD. I guess they're all there for you. Frank, thank you so much for the call. We'd like to take this call now from Brunswick, Georgia. Beth, tell me what you think about Netflix.
Hi, Dave. I love the comment about ADD. I agree. But, and I've given up kind of on hoping that, hope of keeping privacy in our society anymore. But for me, Netflix is the least offensive of that variation on a tune. I love it. Age and some health issues often restrict my activities, keep me in the house. And what saves me sometimes when I can't focus well enough to read or write is watching Netflix. I binge all the time, and I love the documentaries. I love the fiction, the movies, the old television shows. It's a blessing to me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for that, Beth. Kim Masters, you've covered Netflix. You've covered Hollywood for quite some time. To start, what is Netflix attempting to achieve with its suggestions, its algorithms, its continual autoplay of the next show? How are they in some ways cementing that relationship with us as viewers?
Well, it's essential to Netflix that you stay hooked and that you have the next thing that you think you may want to watch. I mean, I've heard that they're among their metrics that they look for when they evaluate is not so much necessarily sometimes whether you watch a show, but whether you've put it in your queue. It's an intent to view, which means that you're engaged and you're not thinking of canceling their subscription. So, you know, they do, of course, with their originals care, and even with the shows they buy from other networks, they care if you're watching them, but they want you to, you know, plan, oh, I really do mean to watch The Crown. And what they're looking for is, you know, right now they're just establishing this gigantic juggernaut that has the rest of Hollywood terrified.
Yeah, I want you to get into that a little bit. You wrote, some time ago, a little more than a year ago, about Hollywood's backlash to Netflix. And, of course, Hollywood is in business with Netflix and receiving this, I'm sure, very welcome new flow of revenue. And when I say Hollywood, I mean the studios, the TV and movie studios that finance so many of these shows and films. You know, I assume the money is pretty welcome. And at the same time, it sounded like from what you were reporting then that a lot of execs were pretty terrified of the implications of this.
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood fed the monster when they realized they could sell their old shows like Friends or, you know, 90210 or whatever to Netflix. These things, and it was like a new source of cash for them, and these things are very useful to the studios, especially when other sources of revenue, like DVD sales, have fallen off so sharply. And the problem is then the studio somewhat got on the pipe in terms of having that Netflix money, and then Netflix started to turn into this thing that was pulling viewers away, and they really at this moment are kind of reckoning with what have we done? We need this monster, but this monster is very scary to us. So it's an interesting push-pull, you know, from the studio's point of view. Disney is already starting to pull back because they're planning to launch their own streaming services, multiple. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Disney could be a competitor.
And presumably with Hulu, you know, Disney and Comcast already have been a competitor, and Fox for that matter, already have been competing in a sense and, you know, providing some of their own original shows as well.
Well, very ambivalently, you know. Hulu is right. More, you know, tiny next to Netflix, but they sort of look. They're in this interesting space where they still go to the upfronts and collect, where they pitch their fall programs, the big networks to advertisers, the big broadcast networks, and they make billions of dollars, and they don't want to risk that by accelerating necessarily this push to streaming, but they know that that's where we're headed. So you see CBS doing, its streaming service and giving you something like Star Trek or the Good Wife's successor show, The Good Fight. Mm-hmm. You could only get it there, and you see Disney, you know, trying to buy Fox because they need more and more material to push into their own. You know, they're going to have stuff with Marvel content. They're going to have stuff for kids. It's going to be, ultimately they will move into that space and are moving into that space. But it's been a kind of a dance of we want the old stuff, but we want the old money from the old stuff, but we want the new money too.
And it seems as though it's been driving a lot of the sort of corporate actions that we've seen, the drive by AT&T to acquire Time Warner, the drive by Comcast perhaps to insert itself into the Disney-Fox deal, and maybe it might be able to cart away some of those the entertainment and TV properties of Fox. Joe Adalian, I want to play for you a clip of Netflix founder, CEO, and Reed Hastings. He was speaking last year at the annual conference staged by the digital site Recode. In that conversation, he described the difference between his company and another tech giant that is putting a lot of money behind creating new content to stream as well. And that, of course, is Amazon.
So we're not trying to meet all needs. So Amazon's business strategy is super broad, meet all needs. I mean, the stuff that'll be in Prime in 5 or 10 years will be amazing, right? And so we can't try to be them. We're never going to be as good as them at what they're trying to be. What we can be is the emotional connection brand, like HBO or Netflix. So think of it as they're trying to be Walmart, we're trying to be Starbucks.
I mean, everybody always wants the other guy to be Walmart in these conversations, right? Nobody ever wants to say, I'm Walmart here, you know, and you're the more artisanal, massive global chain. What distinctions do you see between what Amazon has been doing in putting so much video up through Amazon Prime and through its video services and what Netflix has done?
You know, far be it for me to disagree with Reed Hastings, but I would argue that, in fact, Netflix is blowing away Amazon in terms of content. I mean, Netflix just has so much more content, and they really are aiming for a broader audience. I mean, Amazon, at least until recently, has actually been much more about niche video programming with shows like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and a few other shows that they've done on the comedy side, and now they've changed their entire... Transparent, exactly, yeah, and they've changed management strategies, and now they actually are going broader with Lord of the Rings. I just sort of question that. I do think Amazon as a company is much bigger and broader because it has much more tentacles than just video. But right now, I think I actually think that Netflix's strategy in terms of content is to be Walmart, if maybe a little fancier version of Walmart. I don't think they want to be as broad as, say, they do want to be as broad as network TV. I think they want to have better quality control. And one of the key things that allows Netflix to do that I found is that they have a very decentralized management style within the company, and especially in the programming division. There are so many people at Netflix who can actually green light shows. It allows them to move with more speed and agility than any of the other networks I've ever seen. And you know, there might be 15, 20 people overall who can do that. Now, that isn't that unusual if you think of Netflix as 15 or 16 companies, right? But it does allow them to sort of beat people to market with ideas, to sort of cut through the bureaucracy, and it definitely empowers creators because there's less red tape to get around. They don't have to worry for, you know, there's a note process at Netflix. I didn't get into it in the story, but you know, it's much less imposing. And in general, that's the difference between other networks and Netflix, is that they actually move more quickly and they allow creators to take the front seat in terms of driving their programming.
I want to talk a little bit about the data behind those algorithms that suggest shows and put them, sort of suggest them to go in our queue. They go so quickly. Last year, Netflix's chief product officer, Neil Hunt, was speaking to the network France 24 about what makes his company different when it comes to data usage and to privacy.
They have to serve two masters, my friends who work for those companies. They have to serve the advertisers and they have to serve the consumer. We're a subscription service. With all the data we collect, we only do one thing with that data, and that's to make each individual's experience better.
Differentiation implied there between what Netflix might do with your patterns and what, say, Facebook might do with the data it gathers. Joe Adalian, what'd you gather from your scouting and the information you called from Netflix on all this?
Yeah, I talked to Todd Yellen, who's the head of product at Netflix, about this issue, and absolutely. I mean, they don't even ask your age or ethnicity, which a lot of places do as well. They actually, when they first started in the DVD business, they did sort of think that, oh, well, it would be helpful to us to have some of that demographic information to guide choices. They realized that the best way for them to guide choices was what you watched, and so they stopped asking that, and they just focused on collecting data about what you watch. And sure, if there were ever a data breach, it certainly could pose some privacy risks like anything else. It's not by now. There was a tweet last year that Netflix sent out, I thought rather comically, but some people got very scared about a movie called The Christmas Prince, about how there was 72 people who had watched it like 18 times, and people were like, it's just scary. Netflix knows how many. Well, yes, they do. But, you know, they don't need to share it with advertisers. They're not trying to be an advertiser-supported network. And that's really the problem with Facebook and these other companies, is that they're sharing your data with Cambridge Analytica, which you can use it for other means that you never signed up for.
So you're confident from what you've learned from people at Facebook, both on and off the record, that you know that information is a walled garden, that that's not being shared out for a new funnel of revenue because Netflix is getting so much revenues the other way.
They insist that they don't. They certainly – I don't see any evidence that they're into advertising. I haven't seen – there's sure. no mechanism for advertising on there. So I don't know. You know, if it would seem like a small – it would seem like a weird – I don't think that – I don't know why they would want to share that data with anyone else either because the only one who could use that would be their competitors, right?
Right.
Disney would love to see what people watch on Netflix so they can create their network, but that would be sort of self-defeating. So I didn't dive deep into it. I'm not going to – and certainly who knows if there's ever a security breach, something can happen. But I just don't see the same sort of risk.
I'd like to,
as one of your callers said, by the way, it's sort of compared to other companies, Netflix seems sort of low risk.
Fair enough. I want to take a call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, from a caller who does seem to value Netflix a lot. Sawyer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. I love Netflix, and I'm actually a Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon Prime user, and I love all three.
All streams all the time.
So difficult. Exactly. Anything, anytime. And it's such a great diverse range from all three competitors that I do find it hard with the limited amount of time that I have in the day, be that from work or school. I just don't have enough time in the day to watch everything that I want from all the services. So I have a list on my computer of probably 40 or 50 shows that I want to watch, but I can't get to because I don't have enough time.
40 or 50 shows. Incredible. Sawyer, thanks for that call. Kim Masters, how is Netflix, from your standpoint, changing the nature of the content available to us and the content that may go wide and go big?
I don't know that they actually are. I mean, I think going back to what Joe said earlier, they are, despite what Reed Hastings says, they're attempting to reach every single possible audience. The thing about Netflix that's so striking is, you know, this enormous geyser of programming, this $8 billion a year. So I cover this industry, and I can't keep track of, even begin to keep track of what's on Netflix. We get press releases daily of shows that I've never heard of. They're buying up talent, you know, and the question here in Hollywood is, well, there are two things I would say. One is, from a standpoint of showrunners and people who make shows, yes, it's very tempting to go there and they don't give you as many notes, but that's great if you're Shonda Rhimes or Ryan Murphy or hugely high-profile talent. A lot of these people who go there fear that their shows are being lost, not promoted, and you never know. Are they going to promote my show, or is my show just going to be in this mass of stuff that Netflix is offering? You know, so it's good to be Shonda Rhimes, but it's less good to be someone else. I think there's a question of how, you know, they pitch shows. I was talking to someone I work with, and he has an 11-year-old. Now, they're looking to bring in that 11-year-old, but that 11-year-old has his own little queue of Netflix programming, and all of it is, according to this colleague of mine, kid programming, and he was very upset when they started promoting 13 Reasons Why to this 11-year-old because he felt that there was absolutely nothing in this kid's viewing history that would lead them to think that this kid was ready to see a show that was aimed at older kids and very controversial because of its depiction in the first season of suicide. So very graphic depiction, and, you know, that caused backlash too. So, you know, we're still adjusting to the road here if you're Netflix. It's definitely, they came in with this, we're Silicon Valley, we know how to reinvent things attitude, and Hollywood kind of sat there and said, well, you know, slow down there. There's a reason for the way we do certain things, the way we treat talent, you know, and I think that Netflix is sort of a work in progress, evolving as it expands. How long can it keep up that kind of spend? That's the question everybody asks.
You think ultimately it may be tamed, briefly, Kim, but you think ultimately may be tamed by sort of the norms of Hollywood?
To some degree. And there is the big question, does this hit a wall? You know, they hit a certain number of subscribers, they've got you all hooked, and suddenly they're trying to jack up subscription prices.
That's Kim Masters. We're discussing Netflix and what's behind the company's success. Will it hit a wall? You can join this conversation. Have you scrapped your cable subscription and all contact with the outside world, for that matter, in favor of streaming services like Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu? Does binge-watching sap the soul? We're going to go out with the theme of Netflix's sci-fi hit Sense8. The series finale was released Friday. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're deep inside Netflix this hour and looking at how it's shaking up and reshaping the entertainment industry. You can join the conversation. How often does that autoplay function lull you into watching? What shows are you surprised to find yourself drawn to? How has Netflix changed your relationship with your TV? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook, not surprisingly, at On Point Radio. My guests are Joe Adalian. He's West Coast editor at Vulture.com. And Kim Masters. She's editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter and host of The Business on KCRW. I'd like to bring in another voice. Jessica Kruger is a professor at the University at Buffalo's School of Public Health and Health Professions, where she studies the relationship between binge-watching and mental and physical health. Jessica, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David.
I want to first read you two comments online from listeners. Andrea on Twitter with the handle I Cook I Know Stuff. She writes, I love Netflix, pretty early adopter, but I also kind of missed Blockbuster, which is, I guess, a little bit like missing daguerreotypes, I suppose. Hammerman on our website posts, never have binge watched. It defeats the purpose of episodic TV. That is time for absorption and reflection. Watching a 10-hour series straight is as healthy as eating a whole chocolate cake in one sitting, yum and yuck at the same time. Jessica, tell us a little bit about what your research shows about binge watching and the relationship that viewers have with streaming services, particularly Netflix.
So we know that many people are binge watching out there, and we are looking to see if there are mental health effects in this. What my colleagues and I have found is that people who are engaging in binge TV watching, usually about 2 to 5 hours of watching at a time, show higher levels of stress, anxiety, and depression. What we don't know is what comes first. Are they stressed, anxious, and depressed, and then turning to Netflix? Or after binging, do they feel stressed, anxious, and depressed?
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call from Stratford, Connecticut. Annie is someone who, it sounds like, Annie, that you are happy about Netflix and happy about watching not, in, you know, one show a night or one show a week, but a bunch at a bunch of time. Tell me about it.
Hi, David. I absolutely am. I actually think that one of the benefits of binge watching, and I'm not watching 10 hours in a row, maybe 2 or 3 episodes, but I find that one of the benefits is that it draws me more into the world, not only of the show where I'm going online to find out more information, but the people who make it. You know, I just watched Sense8. Well, now I want to know what else has that composer done. I love the music. I know it's the Wachowskis, and I've watched other things that they've done. But, you know, it also recommended OA to me, and that's opened up a whole new world of interesting artists that I'm not sure I would have stumbled upon on my own. So watching a couple episodes in a row really keeps my mind on those topics and interested in that particular piece.
Annie, a diehard fan. Annie, thanks for your call. Professor Jessica Kruger, tell me, what do you make of that? There's somebody who's saying, hey, look, you know, I can really have a different kind of transportive experience if I watch in a row, if I keep the episodes coming.
Many people have these feelings as they're getting into these shows and relating to these characters. But we also have to worry about the health effects of being sedentary for hours on end. JAMA, a meta-analysis found in that journal, said that 2 hours of watching TV can increase your risk of heart disease, diabetes, and early death. So we really have to think of sitting as the new smoking and worry about the physical aspects and mental health aspects, even if it feels good to get into these shows.
I seem to remember that somewhere there was some service that was going to basically suggest that you cut off or not a streaming service. It wasn't Facebook, but it was basically one social site was basically going to every now and then remind you that it'd be good to step away from the screen, right, in the terminal. Joe Adalian, is there any sense that Netflix takes any responsibility for the addictive nature of what they're creating here?
No more so than any other television network the past 60 years. You know, I think the professor is correct that too much TV watching in one sitting is can be detrimental to one's health. But I would argue that it's no different than any other TV watching that people have done over the years. People have been watching TV for decades.
Well, Joe, let me push back on that. Even your own story, it seemed to me, suggested that, although they were ambivalent about acknowledging it publicly, that, you know, there is something different in that Disney is trying to keep you coming by saying, up next, we got something else. Netflix just has the show pop up in your screen. Now, maybe if you were watching television,
sure,
you know, and you just left it, you know, Fox News viewers, for example, are famous for turning on the TV early in the day and leaving it on all day, as opposed to CNN viewers sampling at various points during the day. But unless you're doing that, you know, ads tend to interrupt the viewing experience and make you at least have the ability to walk out of the room or decide whether or not you want to change the channel. Netflix is doing the opposite. Netflix is flowing you in, right? Joe?
You're right. Netflix is a better delivery system. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are you there? Okay. Netflix is certainly a better delivery system of the addictive drug that is television, right? It's more efficient, it's more alluring, and it definitely can, you're right, it can encourage more viewing and more engagement and more sort of becoming sort of just completely losing yourself into their universe. That's absolutely true. My larger point is that people have been sitting around watching TV for 5 hours after they get home for a long time. And I think what this does, Netflix does, is it expands the universe of potential people who can do that. There might have been people who sort of, you know, would just watch one show or two shows. We're not hardcore TV viewers. It's a lot easier to become what many of us grew up with, families who would just watch, you know, TV for 5-6 hours in a row. So absolutely, it is, video screen consumption time is definitely a problem that applies not just to Netflix, but all sorts of services, including YouTube and others. So it's absolutely, you're right. They certainly are more efficient delivering it, and they know more what you want to watch, and they're more likely to get you into more programs. So you're right. There is sort of an amplification that traditional linear television isn't as able to do.
Sure.
With regular old channel surfing.
I'd like to take a call now from Baltimore, Maryland. Dale is calling, and Dale's somebody who has some insight on one of the first big hits that Netflix had to offer. Dale, go ahead.
Okay. How you doing, David?
Doing well.
Okay. I'm calling about the employment opportunities that Netflix gives and they provide for people who crew these shows. I worked on House of Cards for 6 seasons.
What'd you do, Dale?
Okay. Grip work.
Mm-hmm.
Grip in the rigging department and in the shooting department. Okay. Netflix gave us the opportunity in a small market city in Baltimore, Maryland, a chance to work, which we don't get a lot of work because a lot of the work is sucked up by L.A. and New York. And we're, you know, a small market town, so we don't get a lot. Okay. HBO. I worked on many, many HBO projects as a crew member. Okay, HBO, they paid us the predominantly lowest wage because of their contracts, because of the contracts that they established for years. Netflix came in and paid us a wage way, at least I would say about $10 or $12 more than HBO. And I just want to say that Netflix has been very, very fair to crews like myself, who need money, who want to work in this particular type of industry. And this industry, it's just like any other industry. It's producing a product to be watched by people. So, I mean, I want to present that Netflix has been very fair with the employment opportunities they give many people.
Well, Dale, Dale, I really appreciate your sharing that with the call. House of Cards, an incredible hit, sort of one of the great binge-watching initiators in some ways in terms of its original content. Kim Masters, obviously, House of Cards, also a show that engendered some unwelcome Hollywood-style headlines for Netflix with the accusations of sexual harassment against its star and executive producer, Kevin Spacey. It seems to have emerged from that. How has Netflix done from your standpoint in dealing with this Me Too moment with the more typical Hollywood headaches that are different than the ones that perhaps it thought it would be handling?
Well, I mean, we're swerving into the Me Too moment, and certainly Netflix dropped Kevin Spacey at the speed of light,
mm-hmm.
and which was the right decision. And when someone is dropped at that speed, I think it's because there is a known problem. And so the bright side, we could say, okay, they got rid of him really fast as they needed to because his behavior has been very egregious. The other side is, what did they put up with? You know, what did they know and when did they know it? From a PR point of view, I think they kind of win because I think a lot of people are still sort of nebulous about the Kevin Spacey of it all. They dropped him. They're going to give it a last season. They're giving it a handsome send-off. I think that's good. But again, I go back to, I don't think Kevin Spacey's behavior was was anything other than an open secret. And Netflix, I would assume, like men, they're not the only ones when they have something that works. Maybe they look the other way for a while.
Joe Adalian, we've got a caller calling in who said he passes along the thought, calling from Florida, that he watches Netflix all the time, but my 8-year-old daughter is glued to YouTube, that they together don't watch any TV that comes across traditional broadcast or cable whatsoever. But I wonder if you sensed in your venture behind the streaming curtain, whether there was fear that they would be superseded somehow, that their model would somehow be taken over and be viewed as a dinosaur in 3 to 7 years' time by some newer entry in the field.
Well, they're very confident, as most tech companies are. I think their intent is to be dominant, but they also say they welcome competition, and they think it's good for the landscape, they say. They don't really mean that, I think. But there is competition. YouTube is getting into the production of original programs itself. YouTube already is YouTube precedes Netflix, obviously, in terms of creating viral stars and short-form programming. And YouTube, I think, is trying to compete with YouTube by introducing more short-term content. I have a story going up today, sort of another sidebar, in which I attended a unscripted roadshow, and they're going to do a lot more shows that are just 15-10 minutes long.
Amazon,
even
Apple,
more bite-sized attention.
Amazon, Apple, and many other players entering the field as well. You've just been hearing from Joe Adalian. His cover story for New York Magazine about Netflix kicked all this off. Joe, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Kim Masters is editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter, and she's host of The Business on public radio station KCRW. Kim, glad to have you with us again.
My pleasure.
And Jessica Kruger, she's professor at the University at Buffalo's School of Public Health and Health Professions. Jessica, thanks for sharing some time with us today.
Thank you.
In a moment, Mindy Kaling tells Dartmouth grads to be your own cheerleader. This is On Point. On Sunday, actor and comedian Mindy Kaling addressed Dartmouth College graduates in Hanover, New Hampshire. She talked about her role on The Office, creating and starring in her TV show The Mindy Project, and her new movie Ocean's 8. She also reminisced about when she first came to campus her freshman year.
When I came to Hanover in the fall of 1997, I was, as many of you were, driven, bright, ambitious, and really, really into the Black Eyed Peas. I arrived here as a 17-year-old, took the lay of the land, and immediately began making a checklist of everything I wanted to accomplish. I told myself that by the time I graduated in 2001, I would have checked them all off. And here is my freshman fall checklist. Be on Hanover crew, be on lodge crew, be in an a cappella group, be in an improv troupe, write a play that's performed at the Bentley, and do a cartoon for the D, and try to be in a cool senior society. And guess what? I completed that checklist. But before you think, wait, why is this woman just bragging about her accomplishments from 17 years ago? Keep listening. Then I graduated, and I made a new checklist for my 20s. Get married by 27, have kids at 30, win an Oscar, be the star of my own TV show, host the MTV Music Awards. This was 2001, guys, it made more sense then. And do it all while being a size 2. Well, spoiler alert, I've only done one of those things, and I'm not sure I will ever do the others. And that is a really scary feeling, knowing how far that I've strayed from the person that I was hoping to be when I was 21. I will tell you a personal story. After my daughter was born in December, I remember bringing her home and being in my house with her for the first time and thinking, according to movies and TV, this is traditionally the time when my mother and spouse are supposed to be here sharing this experience with me. And I looked around, and I had neither. And for a moment, it was kind of scary. Like, can I do this by myself? But then, that feeling went away, because the reality is, I'm not doing it by myself. I'm surrounded by family and friends who love and support me. And the joy I feel from being with my daughter, Catherine, eclipses anything from any crazy checklist. So I just want to tell you guys, don't be scared if you don't do things in the right order. Or if you don't do some things at all. I didn't think I'd have a child before I got married, but hey, it turned out that way, and I wouldn't change a thing. I didn't think I'd have dessert before breakfast today, but hey, it turned out that way, and I wouldn't change a thing. So, if I could impart any advice, it's this. If you have a checklist, good for you. Structured ambition can sometimes be motivating, but also feel free to let it go. Yes, my culminating advice for my speech is a song from the Disney animated movie Frozen. I've covered a lot of ground today. Not all of it was serious, but I wanted to leave you with this. I was not someone who should have the life I have now, and yet I do. I was sitting in the chair you are literally sitting in right now, and I just whispered, "Why not me?" And I kept whispering it for 17 years. And here I am, someone that this school deemed worthy enough to speak to you at your commencement. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something, but especially not yourself. Go conquer the world. Just remember this. Why not you? You made it this far. Thank you very much, and congratulations to the class of 2012.
Go conquer the world. Why not you? Those words from the actor Mindy Kaling, who delivered the commencement address to graduates at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, on Sunday. For a video and transcript of her address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Anna Bowman, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Jeremy Rolosa, James Ross, Grace Tatter, Gretchen Voss, and Miriam Wasser, with help from Carolyn Andrews. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me? I'm David Folkenflik. And this is On Point.